That was a high compliment from Mrs. Bug. "Bar the mouldy bread," she added, the corners of her mouth primming slightly. "And that heathen wee pooch you keep in your cabinet. But it's true, no. You're a charmer, like Johnny was." I hesitated, not knowing what to say. The memory of Crane's Muir was vivid in my mind, as it hadn't been for many years. The last thing I wanted was for Mrs. Bug to be spreading the rumour that I was a Carlin. Some already called me a conjure woman. I wasn't worried about legal prosecution as a witch. Not here, not now. But to have a reputation for healing was one thing. To have people come to me for help with the other things that charmers dealt in... "Not exactly," I said guardedly. "It's only that I know a bit about plants and surgery. But I really don't know anything at all about charms or spells." She nodded in satisfaction, as though I had confirmed her suspicions instead of denying them. Before I could respond, there was a sound from the floor like water hitting a hot pan, followed by a loud screech. Jemmy, tiring of his toy, had cast it aside and crawled over to investigate Adso's saucer. The cat, disinclined to share, had hissed at the baby and frightened him. Jemmy's shriek in turn had frightened Adso under the settle. Only the tip of a small pink nose and a flicker of agitated whiskers showed from the shadows. I picked Jem up and soothed his tears while Mrs. Bug took over the broth straining. She looked over the goose debris on the platter and picked out a leg bone, the white cartilage at the end smooth and gleaming. "Here, laddie." She waved it enticingly under Jemmy's nose. He at once stopped crying, grabbed the bone and put it in his mouth. Mrs. Bug selected a smaller wing bone with shreds of meat still clinging to it and put that down on the saucer. "And that's for you, lad," she said to the darkness under the settle. "Dinna fill your wame too full, though. Stay hungry for the wee moosies, aye?" She turned back to the table and began to scoop the bones into a shallow pan. "I'll roast these. They'll do for soup," she said, eyes on her work. Then, without changing tone or looking up, she said, "I went to him once, Johnny Howlett." "Did you?" I sat down, Jemmy on my knee. "Were you ill?" "I wanted a child." I had no idea what to say. I sat still, listening to the drip of broth through the muslin cloth as she scraped the last bit of gristle neatly into the roasting pan and carried it to the hearth. "I'd slip it for in the course of a year," she said, back turned to me. "You'd not think it to look at me now, but I was nae more than skin and bean, the colour away, and my pap shrunk awa to nothing." She settled the pan firmly into the coals and covered it. "So I took what money we had, and I went to Johnny Howlett. He took the money and put water in a pan. He sat me down on the one side of it, and him on the other, and there we sat for a very long time, him staring into the water and me staring at him. At last he shook himself a bit and got up and went to water the back of his cot. "'Twas dark, and I couldn't see what he did, but he rummaged and poked and said things beneath his breath, and finally he came back to me and handed me a charm.' Mrs. Bug straightened up and turned round. She came close and laid her hands on Jemmy's silky head very gently. "He said to me," Johnny did, "that here was a charm that would close up the mouth of my womb and keep a babe safe inside until it should be born. But there was one thing he'd seen, looking in the water, and he must tell me. If I bore a live babe, then my husband would die," he said. "So he would give me the charm and the prayer that went with it, and then it was my choice. And who could see fairer than that?" Her stubby, work-worn finger traced the curve of Jemmy's cheek. Engaged with his new toy, he paid no attention. "I carried that charm in my pocket for a month, and then I put it away." I reached up and put my hand over hers, squeezing. There was no sound but the baby slobbering and the hiss and pop of the bones in the coals. She stayed still for a moment, then drew her hand away and put it back in her pocket. She drew out a small object and put it on the table beside me. "I couldn't quite bring myself to throw it away," she said, gazing down at it dispassionately. "It cost me 3 silver pennies, after all. And it's a wee thing, easy enough to carry along when we left Scotland." It was a small chunk of stone, pale pink in colour, and veined with grey, badly weathered. It had been crudely carved into the shape of a pregnant woman, little more than a huge belly with swollen breasts and buttocks above a pair of stubby legs that tapered to nothing. I'd seen such figures before, in museums. Had Johnny Howlett made it himself? Or perhaps found it in his pokings through wood and moor, a remnant of much more ancient times? I touched it gently, thinking that whatever Johnny Howlett might have been or might have seen in his pan of water, he had no doubt been astute enough to have seen the love between Arch and Merdina Bug. Was it easier for a woman, then, to forswear the hope of children, thinking it a noble sacrifice for the sake of a much-loved husband, than to suffer bitterness and self-blame for constant failure? Carlin he may have been, Johnny Howlett, but a charmer indeed. "So," Mrs. Bug said matter-of-factly, "it may be as you'll find some lass who's a use for it. Shame to let it go to waste, aye?" Chapter 35. Hogmanay. The year ended clear and cold, with a small brilliant moon that rose high in the violet-black vault of the sky and flooded the coves and trails of the mountainside with light. A good thing, as people came from all over the ridge, and some even farther, to keep Hogmanay at the big house. The men had cleared the new barn and raked the floor clean for the dancing. Jigs and reels and strathspeys, and a number of other dances for which I didn't know the names, but they looked like fun, were executed under the light of bare oil lanterns, accompanied by the music of Evan Lindsay's scratchy fiddle and the squeal of his brother Murdo's wooden flute, punctuated by the heartbeat thump of Kenny's Bothlan. Thurlow Guthrie's ancient father had brought his pipes too, a set of small Illan pipes that looked nearly as decrepit as did Mr. Guthrie, but produced a sweet drone. The melody of his chanter sometimes agreed with the Lindsay's notion of a particular tune, and sometimes didn't, but the overall effect was cheerful, and sufficient whisky and beer had been taken by this point in the festivities that no one minded in the least. After an hour or two of the dancing, I privately decided that I understood why the word real had come to indicate drunkenness. Even performed without preliminary lubrication, the dance was enough to make one dizzy. Done under the influence of whiskey, it made all the blood in my head whirl round like the water in a washing machine. I staggered off at the end of one such dance, leaned against one of the barn's uprights, and closed one eye in hopes of stopping the spinning sensation. A nudge on my blind side caused me to open that eye, revealing Jamie holding 2 brimming cups of something. Hot and thirsty as I was, I didn't mind what it was, so long as it was wet. Fortunately, it was cider, and I gulped it. "Drink it like that, and you'll founder, Sassenach," he said, disposing of his own cider in precisely similar fashion. He was flushed and sweating from the dancing, but his eyes sparkled as he grinned at me. "Piffle," I said. With a bit of cider as ballast, the room had quit spinning, and I felt cheerful, if hot. "How many people are in here, do you think?"
68, last time I counted.
He leaned back beside me, viewing the milling throng with an expression of deep content.
"They come in and out, though, so I cannot be quite sure. And I didn't count the wains," he added, moving slightly to avoid collision as a trio of small boys caromed through the crowd and shot past us, giggling.
Heaps of fresh hay were stacked in the shadows at the sides of the barn. The small bodies of children, too wee to stay awake, were draped and curled among them like so many barn kittens. The flicker of lantern light caught a gleam of silky red gold, Jemmy was sound asleep in his blanket, happily lulled by the racket. I saw Bree come out of the dancing and lay her hand briefly on him to check, then turn back. Roger put out a hand to her, dark and smiling, and she took it, laughing as they whirled back into the stamping mass. People did come in and out, particularly small groups of young people and courting couples. It was freezing and frost crisp outside, but the cold made cuddling with a warm body that much more appealing. One of the older MacLeod boys passed near us, his arm round a much younger girl. One of old Mr. Guthrie's granddaughters, I thought. He had three of them, all much alike to look at. And Jamie said something genial to him in Gaelic that made his ears go red. The girl was already pink with dancing, but went crimson in the face. "What did you say to them?"
"That doesn't bear translation," he said, putting a hand in the small of my back.
He was pulsing with heat and whiskey, alight with a flame of joy. Looking at him was enough to kindle my own heart. He saw that and smiled down at me, the heat of his hand burning through the cloth of my gown.
"Do you want to go outside for a moment, Sassenach?" he said,
his voice pitched low and rich with suggestion.
"Well, since you mention it."
"Yes," I said.
"Maybe not just yet, though."
I nodded past him, and he turned to see a cluster of elderly ladies sitting on a bench against the wall, all viewing us with the bright-eyed curiosity of a flock of crows. Jamie waved and smiled at them, making them all burst into pink-faced giggles, and turned back to me with a sigh.
"I will, in a bit, then. After the first footing, maybe."
The latest spate of dancing came to an end, and there was a general surge in the direction of the tub of cider, presided over by Mr. Weems at the far end of the barn. The dancers clustered round it like a horde of thirsty wasps, so that all that was visible of Mr. Weems was the top of his head, fair hair almost white under the glow of the lanterns. Seeing it, I looked round for Lizzie to see whether she was enjoying the party. Evidently so. She was holding court on a hay bale, surrounded by four or five gawky boys, who were all behaving very much like the dancers round the cider tub.
"Who's the big one?"
I asked Jamie, calling his attention to the small gathering with a nod of my head.
"I don't recognise him."
He glanced over, squinting slightly.
"Oh," he said, relaxing, "that'll be Jakob Schnell. He's ridden over from Salem with a friend. They came with the mules."
"Really? Salem was a good long ride, nearly 30 miles. I wondered whether the attraction had been the festivities alone.
I looked for Tommy Mueller, whom I had privately marked out as a possible match for Lizzie, but didn't see him in the crowd.
"Do you know anything about this Schnell lad?" I asked, giving the boy in question a critical look. He was a year or two older than the other boys dancing attendance on Lizzie, and quite tall. Plain-featured but good-natured-looking, I thought. Heavy-boned, and with a thickness through the middle that foretold the development of a prosperous paunch in middle age.
"I didn't ken the lad myself, but I've met his uncle. It's a decent family. I think his father's a cobbler."
We both looked automatically at the young man's shoes. Not new, but very good quality, and with pewter buckles, large and square in the German fashion. Young Schnell appeared to have gained an advantage. He was leaning close, saying something to Lizzie, whose eyes were fixed on his face, a slight frown of concentration wrinkling the skin between her fair brows as she tried to make out what he was saying. Then she worked it out, and her face relaxed in laughter.
"I dinna think so."
Jamie shook his head, a slight frown on his face as he watched them.
"The family's Lutheran. They wouldna let the lad marry a Catholic. And it would break Joseph's heart to send the lass to live so far away."
Lizzie's father was deeply attached to her, and having lost her once, he was unlikely to give her so far away in marriage as to lose sight of her again. Still, I thought that Joseph Weems would do almost anything to ensure his daughter's happiness.
"He might go with her, you know."
Jamie's expression grew bleak at the thought,
but he nodded in reluctant acknowledgement.
I suppose so. I should hate to lose him. Though I suppose Archbug might...
Shouts of Magdu interrupted him.
Come on, Hamish Roar. Show him how.
Evan called from the far end of the barn and jerked his bow authoritatively. There had been a break in the dancing to give the musicians time to breathe and have a drink, and in the interim, some of the men had been trying their hand at sword dancing, which could be done with only the accompaniment of pipes or to a single drum. I had been paying little attention to this, only hearing the shouts of encouragement or derision from that end of the barn. Evidently, most of those present were no great hand at the sport. The latest gentleman to try it had tripped over one of the swords and fallen flat. He was being helped to his feet, red-faced and laughing, returning genial insults with his friends as they beat the hay and dirt from his clothes.
"Magdu! Magdu!"
Kenny and Murdo shouted in invitation, beckoning. But Jamie waved them off, laughing.
"Nee, I haven't done that in more time than I... Magdu! Magdu! Magdu!"
Kenny was thumping his bothron, chanting in rhythm, and the group of men around him were joining in.
Magdu! Magdu! Magdu!
Jamie cast me a brief look of helpless appeal, but Ronnie Sinclair and Bobby Sutherland were already heading purposefully toward us. I stepped away laughing, and they seized him, each by an arm, smothering his protests with raucous shouts as they hustled him into the centre of the floor. Applause and shouts of approval broke out as they deposited him in a clear space, where the straw had been trampled into the damp earth far enough to make a hard-packed surface. Seeing that he had no choice, Jamie drew himself up and straightened his kilt. He caught my eye, rolled an eye in mock resignation, and began to take off his coat, waistcoat, and boots, as Ronnie scrambled to lay out the two crossed broadswords at his feet. Kenny Lindsay began to tap gently on his bothron, hesitating between the beats, a sound of soft suspense. The crowd murmured and shifted in anticipation. Clad in shirt, kilt, and stockinged feet, Jamie bowed elaborately, turning sunwise to dip four times, to each of the erts in turn. Then he stood upright and moved to take his place, standing just above the crossed swords. His hands lifted, fingers pointing stiff above his head. There was an outburst of clapping nearby, and I saw Brianna put two fingers in her mouth and give an ear-splitting whistle of approbation, to the marked shock of the people standing next to her. I saw Jamie glance at Bree with a faint smile, and then his eyes found mine again. The smile stayed on his lips, but there was something different in his expression, something rueful. The beat of the bothron began to quicken. A Highland sword dance was done for one of three reasons. For exhibition and entertainment, as he was about to do it now. For competition, as it was done among the young men at a gathering. And, as it first was done, as an omen. Danced on the eve of a battle, the skill of the dancer foretold success or failure. The young men had danced between crossed swords the night before Prestonpans, before Falkirk, but not before Culloden. There had been no campfires the night before that final fight. No time for bards and battle songs. It didn't matter. No one had needed an omen then. Jamie closed his eyes for a moment, bent his head, and the beat of the drum began to patter, quick and fast. I knew, because he had told me, that he had first done the sword dance in competition, and then, more than once, on the eve of battles, first in the Highlands, then in France. The old soldiers had asked him to dance, had valued his skill as reassurance that they would live in triumph. For the Lindsays to have known his skill, he must also have danced in Ardsmuir. But that was in the old world, and in his old life. He knew, and had not needed Roger to tell him, that the old ways had changed, were changing. This was a new world, and the sword dance would never again be danced in earnest, seeking omen and favour from the ancient gods of war and blood. His eyes opened and his head snapped up.
The tipper struck the drum with a sudden thunk, and it began with a shout from the crowd. His feet struck down on the pounded earth to the north and the south, to the east and the west, flashing swift between the swords. His feet struck soundless, sure on the ground, and his shadow danced on the wall behind him, looming tall, long arms upraised. His face was still toward me, but he didn't see me any longer, I was sure. The muscles of his legs were strong as a leaping stag's beneath the hem of his kilt, and he danced with all the skill of the warrior he had been, and still was. But I thought he danced now only for the sake of memory, that those watching might not forget. Danced, with the sweat flying from his brow as he worked, and a look of unutterable distance in his eyes. People were still talking of it when we adjourned to the house just before midnight, for stovies, beer and cider before the first footing. Mrs. Bug brought out a basket of apples and gathered all the young unmarried girls together in a corner of the kitchen, where, with much giggling and glancing over shoulders toward the young men, each peeled a fruit, keeping the peeling in one piece. Each girl tossed her peel behind her, and the group all whirled round to cluster and claim over the fallen strip, and see what was the shape of the letter it made. Apple peelings, being by their nature fairly circular, there were a good many C's, G's and O's discovered. Good news for Charlie Chisholm and young Geordie Sutherland, and much speculation as to whether Angus Og might be the meaning of an O or not. For Angus Og MacLeod was a canty lad and much liked, while the only Owen was an elderly widower, about 5 feet tall and with a large wen on his face. I had taken Jemmy up to put him to bed, and after depositing him limp and snoring in his cradle, came down in time to see Lizzie cast her peeling. "See?" chorused two of the Guthrie girls, almost knocking heads as they bent to look. "No, no, it's a J." Appealed to as the resident expert, Mrs. Bug bent down, eyeing the strip of red peel with her head on one side, like a robin sizing up a likely worm. "A J it is, to be sure," she ruled, straightening up, and the group burst out in giggles, turning as one to stare at John Lowry, a young farmer from Woolham's Mill, who peered over his shoulder at them in total bewilderment. I caught a flash of red from the corner of my eye and turned to see Brianna in the doorway to the hall. She tilted her head, beckoning me, and I hurried to join her. "Roger's ready to go out, but we couldn't find the ground salt. It wasn't in the pantry." "Do you have it in your surgery?"
"Oh, yes, I have," I said guiltily.
"I'd been using it to dry snake root and forgot to put it back." Guests packed the porches and lined the wide hallway, spilling out of the kitchen and Jamie's study, all talking, drinking and eating. I threaded my way through the crush after her toward my surgery, exchanging greetings as I ducked brandished cups of cider, stovey crumbs crunching under my feet. The surgery itself was nearly empty, though. People tended to avoid it through superstition, painful associations, or simple wariness, and I hadn't encouraged them to go in, leaving the room dark with no fire burning. Only one candle was burning in the room now, and the only person present was Roger, who was poking among the bits and pieces I'd left on the counter. He looked up as we entered, smiling. Still faintly flushed from the dancing, he had put his coat back on and draped a woolen scarf round his neck. His cloak lay over the stool beside him. Custom held that the most fortunate first foot on a hogmanay was a tall and handsome dark-haired man. To welcome one as the first visitor across the threshold after midnight brought good fortune to the house for the coming year. Roger, being beyond argument the tallest and quite the best-looking dark man available, he had been elected to be first foot, not only for the big house, as folk called it, but for those homes nearby. Fergus and Masali and the others who lived near had already rushed off to their houses to be ready to greet their first foot when he should come. A red-haired man, though, was frightful ill luck as a first foot, and Jamie had been consigned to his study under the riotous guard of the Lindsay brothers, who were to keep him safely bottled up till after midnight.
There were no clocks nearer than Cross Creek, but old Mr. Guthrie had a pocket watch, even older than himself. This instrument would declare the mystic moment when one year yielded to the next. Given the watch's propensity for stopping, I doubted that this would be more than a symbolic pronouncement, but that was quite enough after all.
11:50, Brianna declared, popping into the surgery after me, her own cloak over her arm. I just checked Mr. Guthrie's watch.
Plenty of time.
Are you coming with me, then?
Roger grinned at Bree, seeing her cloak.
Are you kidding? I haven't been out after midnight in years.
She grinned back at him, swirling the cloak around her shoulders.
Got everything? All but the salt.
Roger nodded toward a canvas bag on the counter. A first foot was to bring gifts to the house. An egg, a faggot of wood, a bit of salt, and a bit of whiskey. Thus ensuring that the household wouldn't lack for necessities during the coming year.
Right. Where did I... Oh, Christ!
Swinging open the cupboard door to search for the salt, I was confronted by a pair of glowing eyes glaring out of the darkness at me.
Good grief.
I put a hand over my chest to keep my heart from leaping out, waving the other hand weakly at Roger, who had sprung up at my cry, ready to defend me.
Not to worry. It's just the cat.
Adso had taken refuge from the party, bringing along the remains of a freshly killed mouse for company. He growled at me, evidently thinking I meant to snatch this treat for myself, but I pushed him crossly aside, digging the small bag of ground salt out from behind his furry hindquarters. I closed the cupboard door, leaving Adso to his feast, and handed Roger the salt. He took it, laying down the object he had had in his hand.
"Where did you get that, wee old wifey?" he asked, nodding toward the object as he put the salt away in his bag.
I glanced at the counter and saw that he had been examining the little pink stone figure that Mrs. Bug had given me.
"Mrs. Bug," I replied. "She says it's a fertility charm, which is certainly what it looks like. It is very old, then."
I thought it must be, and seeing Roger's interest confirmed the impression. He nodded, still looking at the thing.
Very old. The ones I've seen in museums are dated at thousands of years.
He traced the bulbous outlines of the stone with a reverent forefinger. Brianna moved closer to see, and without thinking, I set a hand on her arm.
What? She said, turning her head to smile at me. I shouldn't touch it.
Do they work that well?
No, of course not.
I took my hand away, laughing, but feeling rather self-conscious. At the same time, I became aware that I would really rather she didn't touch it, and was relieved when she merely bent down to examine it, leaving it on the counter. Roger was looking at it too. Or rather, he was looking at Brianna, his eyes fixed on the back of her head with an odd intensity. I could almost imagine that he was willing her to touch the thing, as strongly as I was willing her not to.
"Beecham," I said silently to myself, "you have had much too much to drink tonight."
All the same, I reached out by impulse and scooped the figure up, dropping it into my pocket.
"Come on, we have to go."
The odd mood of the moment abruptly broken, Brianna straightened up and turned to Roger, urging him.
"Aye, right. Let's go, then."
He slung the bag over his shoulder, smiled at me, then took her arm, and they disappeared, letting the surgery door close behind them. I put out the candle, ready to follow them, and then stopped, suddenly reluctant to go back at once to the chaos of the celebration. I could feel the whole house in movement, throbbing around me, and light flowed under the door from the hall. Just here, though, it was quiet. In the silence, I felt the weight of the little idol in my pocket and pressed it, hard and lumpy, against my leg. There is nothing special about January the 1st, save the meaning we give to it. The ancients celebrated a new year at Imbolc, at the beginning of February, when the winter slackens and the light begins to come back. Or the date of the spring equinox, when the world lies in balance between the powers of dark and light. And yet, I stood there in the dark, listening to the sound of the cat chewing and slobbering in the cupboard, and felt the power of the earth shift and stir beneath my feet as the year, or something, prepared to change. There was noise and the sense of a crowd nearby, and yet I stood alone, while the feeling rose through me, hummed in my blood. The odd thing was that it wasn't strange in the slightest. It was nothing that came from outside me, but only the acknowledgement of something I already possessed and recognised, though I had no notion what to call it. But midnight was fast approaching. Still wondering, I opened the door and stepped into the light and clamour of the hall. A shout from across the hall betokened the arrival of the magic hour, as announced by Mr. Guthrie's timepiece, and the men came jostling out of Jamie's office, joking and pushing, faces turned expectantly toward the door. Nothing happened. Had Roger decided to go to the back door, given the crowd in the kitchen? I turned to look down the hall, but no. The kitchen doorway was crowded with faces, all looking back at me in expectation. Still no knock at the door, and there was a small stir of restiveness in the hallway, and a lull in conversation. One of those awkward silences when no one wants to talk for fear of sudden interruption. Then I heard the sound of footsteps on the porch and a rapid knock. 1, 2, 3. Jamie, as householder, stepped forward to fling the door open and bid the first foot welcome. I was near enough to see the look of astonishment on his face and looked quickly to see what had caused it. Instead of Roger and Brianna, two smaller figures stood on the porch. Skinny and bedraggled, but definitely dark-haired, the two Beardsley twins stepped shyly in together at Jamie's gesture.
"Happy New Year to you, Mr. Fraser," said Josiah in a bullfrog croak.
He bowed politely to me, still holding his brother by the arm.
"We've come."
This ends Disc 18. The Fiery Cross, Disc 19.
The general agreement was that dark-haired twins were a most fortunate omen, obviously bringing twice the luck of a single first foot. Nonetheless, Roger and Bree, who had met the twins hesitating in the yard and sent them up to the door, went off to do their best for the other houses on the ridge, Bree being severely warned not to enter any house until Roger had crossed the threshold. Fortunate or not, the appearance of the Beardsleys caused a good deal of talk. Everyone had heard of the death of Aaron Beardsley, the official version, that is, which was that he had perished of an apoplexy, and the mysterious disappearance of his wife. But the advent of the twins caused the whole affair to be raked up and talked over again. No one knew what the boys had been doing between the militia's expedition and New Year's. Josiah said only, "Wandering?" in his raspy croak when asked, and his brother, Keziah, said nothing at all, obliging everybody to talk about the Indian trader and his wife until exhaustion caused a change of subject. Mrs. Bug took the Beardsleys at once under her wing, taking them off to the kitchen to be washed, warmed, and fed. Half the party-goers had gone home to be first-footed, those who wouldn't leave till morning split into several groups. The younger people returned to the barn to dance, or to seek a bit of privacy among the hay bales. The older ones sat to talk of memories by the hearth, and those who had overindulged in dance or whiskey curled up in any convenient corner, and quite a few inconvenient ones, to sleep. I found Jamie in his study, leaning back in his chair with his eyes closed, a drawing of some kind on the table before him. He wasn't asleep, and opened his eyes when he heard my step. "Happy New Year," I said softly, and bent to kiss him.
"A good New Year to you, Aneon Doan."
He was warm and smelled faintly of beer and dried sweat.
"Still want to go outside?" I asked, with a glance at the window.
The moon had set long since, and the stars burned faint and cold in the sky. The yard outside was bleak and black.
"No," he said frankly, rubbing a hand over his face. "I want to go to bed."
He yawned and blinked, trying to smooth down the dishevelled bits of hair sticking up on the top of his head.
"I want you to come too, though," he added generously.
I'd like nothing better, I assured him. What's that? I circled round behind him, looking over his shoulder at the drawing, which seemed to be some sort of floor plan, with mathematical calculations scribbled in the margins. He sat up, looking a trifle more alert.
Oh, well, this is Wee Roger's gift to Brianna, for Hogmanay.
He's building her a house, but they...
Not her.
He grinned up at me, hands flat on either side of the drawing.
The Chisholms.
Roger, with a guile that would have become Jamie himself, had scouted round among the settlers on the ridge and engineered an agreement between Ronnie Sinclair and Geordie Chisholm. Ronnie had a large and commodious cabin next to his cooperage, so the agreement was that Ronnie, who was unmarried, would move into the cooper's shop where he could easily sleep. The Chisholms would then move into Ronnie's cabin, to which they would at once, weather allowing, add two rooms, as per the plan on Jamie's table. In return, Mrs. Chisholm would undertake to make Ronnie's meals and do his washing. In the spring, when the Chisholms took possession of their own homestead and built a house there, Ronnie would take back his newly enlarged cabin. When the grandness of his improved accommodation might prove sufficient inducement for some young woman to accept his proposal of marriage, he hoped. And in the meantime, Roger and Bree get back their cabin, Lizzie and her father stop sleeping in the surgery, and everything is beer and skittles. I squeezed his shoulders, delighted. That's a wonderful arrangement.
What's a skittle? He inquired, frowning back at me in puzzlement.
One of a set of ninepins, I said. I believe the expression is meant to exemplify a state of general delight with prevailing conditions. Did you do the plan?
Aye, Geordie's new carpenter, and I didn't want the place to fall down about his ears.
He squinted at the drawings, then took a quill from the jar, flipped open the inkwell, and made a small correction to one of the figures.
There, he said, dropping the quill. That'll do. Wee Roger wants to show it to Bree when they come back tonight. I said I'd leave it out for him.
She'll be thrilled.
I leaned against the back of his chair, massaging his shoulders with my hands. He leaned back, the weight of his head warm against my stomach, and closed his eyes, sighing in pleasure.
Headache? I asked softly, seeing the vertical line between his eyes.
Aye, just a bit. Ooh, aye, that's nice.
I had moved my hands to his head, gently rubbing his temples. The house had quieted, though I could still hear the rumble of voices in the kitchen. Beyond them, the high, sweet sound of Evan's fiddle drifted through the cold, still air. My brown-haired maid, I said, sighing reminiscently. I do love that song. I pulled loose the ribbon binding his plait and unbraided the hair, enjoying the soft, warm feel of it as I spread it with my fingers.
It's rather odd that you don't have an ear for music, I said, making small talk to distract him as I smoothed the ruddy arcs of his brows, pressing just within the edge of the orbit. I don't know why, but an aptitude for mathematics often goes along with one for music. Bree has both.
I used to,
he said absently.
Used to what?
Have both.
He sighed and bent forward to stretch his neck, his elbows resting on the table.
Oh, Christ. Please. Oh, I. Ah.
Really?
I massaged his neck and shoulders, kneading the tight muscles hard through the cloth.
You mean you used to be able to sing?
It was a family joke. While possessed of a fine speaking voice, Jamie's sense of pitch was so erratic that any song in his voice was a chant so tuneless that babies were stunned rather than lulled to sleep.
Well, perhaps not that so much.
I could hear the smile in his voice, muffled by the fall of hair that hid his face.
I could tell one tune from another, though, or say if a song was badly sung or well. Now it's no but noise or screeching.
He shrugged, dismissing it. What happened? I asked.
And when? Oh, it was before I came to Sassenach. In fact, quite soon before.
He lifted a hand, reaching toward the back of his head.
Do you recall I'd been in France? It was on my way back with Dougal Mackenzie and his men when Murtagh came across you, wandering the Highlands in your shift.
He spoke lightly, but my fingers had found the old scar under his hair. It was no more now than a thread, the welted gash healed to a hair-breadth line. Still, it had been an 8-inch wound laid open with an axe. It had nearly killed him at the time, I knew. He had lain near death in a French abbey for 4 months, and suffered from crippling headaches for years. It was that. You mean that you couldn't hear music any more after you were hurt? His shoulders lifted briefly in a shrug.
I hear no music but the sound of drums, he said simply. I've the rhythm of it still, but the tune is gone.
I stopped, my hands on his shoulders, and he turned to look back at me, smiling, trying to make a joke of it.
Dinna be troubled for it, Sassenach. It's no great matter. I didna sing well enough even when I could hear it. And Dougal didna kill me, after all.
Dougal? You do think it was Dougal, then? I was surprised at the certainty in his voice. He had thought at the time that it might perhaps have been his uncle Dougal who had made the murderous attack upon him, and then, surprised by his own men before being able to finish the job, had pretended instead to have found him wounded. But there had been no evidence to say for sure.
Oh, aye.
He looked surprised, too, but then his face changed, realizing.
Oh, aye, he said again, more slowly. I hadn't a thought. You couldn't tell what he said, could you? When he died, I mean. Dougal.
My hands were still resting on his shoulders, and I felt an involuntary shiver run through him. It spread through my hands and up my arms, raising the hairs all the way to the back of my neck. As clearly as though the scene took place before me now, I could see that attic room in Culloden House. The bits and pieces of discarded furniture, things toppled and rolling from the struggle. And on the floor at my feet, Jamie crouched, grappling with Dougal's body as it bucked and strained, blood and air bubbling from the wound where Jamie's dirk had pierced the hollow of his throat. Dougal's face, blanched and mottled as his life-blood drained away, eyes fierce, black, and fixed on Jamie as his mouth moved in Gaelic silence, saying something. And Jamie's face, as white as Dougal's, eyes locked on the dying man's lips, reading that last message. What did he say? My hands were tight on his shoulders, and his face was turned away as my thumbs rose up under his hair to seek the ancient scar again.
Sister, son, or no, I would that I had killed you that day on the hill, for I knew from the beginning that it would be you or me.
He spoke calm and low-voiced, and the very emotionlessness of the words made the shudder pass again, this time from me to him. It was quiet in the study. The sound of voices in the kitchen had died to a murmur, as though the ghosts of the past gathered there to drink and reminisce, laughing softly among themselves. "So that was what you meant," I said quietly, "when you said you'd made your peace with Dougal."
"Aye."
He leaned back in his chair and reached up, his hands wrapping warmly around my wrists.
"He was right, Ken. It was him or me, and would have been, one way or the other."
I sighed, and a small burden of guilt dropped away. Jamie had been fighting to defend me when he killed Dougal, and I had always felt that death to be laid at my door. But he was right, Dougal. Too much lay between them. And if that final conflict had not come then, on the eve of Culloden, it would have been another time. Jamie squeezed my wrists and turned in his chair, still holding my hands.
"Let the dead bury the dead, Sassenach," he said softly. "The past is gone. The future is not come. And we are here together, you and I.
Chapter 36. Worlds Unseen. The household was quiet. It was the perfect opportunity for my experiments. Mr. Bug had gone to Woolham's Mill, taking the Beardsley twins. Lizzie and Mr. Weems had gone to help Masali with the new mash, and Mrs. Bug, having left a pot of porridge and a platter of toast in the kitchen, was out too, combing the woods for the half-wild hens, catching them one by one, and dragging them in by the feet to be installed in the handsome new chicken coop her husband had built. Bree and Roger sometimes came up to the big house for their breakfast, but more often chose to eat by their own half, as was the case this morning. Enjoying the peace of the empty house, I made up a tray with cup, teapot, cream and sugar, and took it with me to my surgery, along with my samples. The early morning light was perfect, pouring through the windows in a brilliant bar of gold. Leaving the tea to steep, I took a couple of small glass bottles from the cupboard and went outside. The day was chilly but beautiful, with a clear, pale sky that promised a little warmth later in the morning. At the moment, though, it was cold enough that I was glad of my warm shawl, and the water in the horse's trough was frigid, rimmed with sheets of fragile ice. Not cold enough to kill the microbes, I supposed. I could see long strands of algae coating the boards of the trough, swaying gently as I buckled the thin crust of ice and disturbed the water, scraping one of my bottles along the slimy edge of the trough. I scooped up further samples of liquid from the springhouse and from a puddle of muddy standing water near the privy, then hurried back to the house to make my trials while the light was still good. The microscope stood by the window where I had set it up the day before, all gleaming brass and bright mirrors. A few seconds' work to place droplets on the glass slides I'd laid ready, and I bent to peer through the eyepiece with rapt anticipation. The ovoid of light bulged, diminished, went out altogether. I squinted, turning the screw as slowly as I could, and there it was. The mirror steadied and the light resolved itself into a perfect pale circle, window to another world. I watched enchanted as the madly beating cilia of a paramecium bore it in hot pursuit of invisible prey. Then a quiet drifting. The field of view itself in constant movement as the drop of water on my slide shifted in its microscopic tides. I waited a moment more, in hopes of spotting one of the swift and elegant Euglena, or even a Hydra, but no such luck. Only bits of mysterious black-green, daubs of cellular debris, and burst algal cells. I shifted the slide to and fro, but found nothing else of interest. Well, that was all right. I had plenty of other things to look at. I rinsed the glass rectangle in a cup of alcohol, let it dry for a moment, then dipped a glass rod into one of the small beakers I had lined up before my microscope, dabbing a drop of liquid onto the clean slide. It had taken some experimentation to put the microscope together properly. It wasn't much like a modern version, particularly when reduced to its component parts for storage in Dr. Rawling's handsome box. Still, the lenses were recognisable, and with that as a starting point, I had managed to fit the optical bits into the stand without much trouble. Obtaining sufficient light, though, had been more difficult, and I was thrilled finally to have got it working. "What are you doing, Sassenach?" Jamie, with a piece of toast in one hand, paused in the doorway. "Seeing things," I said, adjusting the focus. "Why? What sort of things?" He came into the room, smiling. "Not ghosties, I trust. I will have had enough of those."
"Come look," I said,
stepping back from the microscope. Mildly puzzled, he bent and peered through the eyepiece, screwing up his other eye in concentration. He squinted for a moment, then gave an exclamation of pleased surprise.
"I see them. Wee things with tails swimming all about."
He straightened up, smiling at me with a look of delight, then bent at once to look again. I felt a warm glow of pride in my new toy.
"Isn't it marvellous?"
"Aye, marvellous," he said, absorbed. "Look at them. Such busy wee strivers as they are, all pushing and writhing against one another. Such a mass of them."
He watched for a few moments more, exclaiming under his breath, then straightened up, shaking his head in amazement.
"I've never seen such a thing, Sassenach. You told me all about the germs, aye, but I never in life imagined them so. I thought they might have wee teeth, and they don't. But I never kent they would have such handsome, lashing wee tails, or swim about in such numbers."
"Well, some microorganisms do," I said, moving to peer into the eyepiece again myself. "These particular little beasts aren't germs, though. They're sperms."
"They're what?"
He looked blank. "Sperms," I said patiently. "Male reproductive cells. You know, what makes babies." I thought he might just possibly choke. His mouth opened and a very pretty shade of rose suffused his countenance.
"You mean seed?" he croaked.
"Spunk?" "Well, yes." Watching him narrowly, I poured steaming tea into a clean beaker and handed it to him as a restorative. He ignored it, though, his eyes fixed on the microscope as though something might spring out of the eyepiece at any moment and go writhing across the floor at our feet.
"Sperms,"
he muttered to himself.
"Sperms."
He shook his head vigorously, then turned to me, a frightful thought having just occurred to him.
"Whose are they?"
he asked, his tone one of darkest suspicion.
Well, yours, of course."
I cleared my throat, mildly embarrassed.
"Who else's would they be?"
His hand darted reflexively between his legs and he clutched himself protectively.
"How the hell did you get them?"
"How do you think?" I said, rather coldly. "I woke up in custody of them this morning." His hand relaxed, but a deep blush of mortification stained his cheeks dark crimson. He picked up a beaker of tea and drained it at a gulp, temperature notwithstanding.
"I see,"
he said, and coughed. There was a moment of deep silence.
"I didn't ken they could stay alive," he said at last. Outside, I mean."
"Well, if you leave them in a splotch on the sheet to dry out, they don't," I said, matter-of-factly. "Keep them from drying out, though," I gestured at the small covered beaker, with its small puddle of whitish fluid, "and they'll do for a few hours. In their proper habitat, though, they can live for up to a week after, release."
"Proper habitat," he repeated, looking pensive.
He darted a quick glance at me.
"You do mean..."
"I do," I said, with some asperity. At this point he recalled the piece of toast he still held, and took a bite, chewing meditatively.
"Do folk know about this? Now, I mean."
"Know what? What sperm look like?"
"Almost certainly. Microscopes have been around for well over 100 years, and the first thing anyone with a working microscope does is to look at everything within reach. Given that the inventor of the microscope was a man, I should certainly think that..." "Don't you?"
He gave me a look and took another bite of toast, chewing in a marked manner.
"I shouldn't have quite liked to refer to it as within reach, Sassenach," he said, through a mouthful of crumbs and swallowed. "But I do take your meaning."
As though compelled by some irresistible force, he drifted toward the microscope, bending to peer into it once more.
"They seem very fierce," he ventured, after a few moments' inspection.
"Well, they do need to be," I said, suppressing a smile at his faintly abashed air of pride in his gamete's prowess. "It's a long slog, after all, and a terrific fight at the end of it. Only one gets the honour, you know." He looked up, blank-faced. It dawned on me that he didn't know. He'd studied languages, mathematics, and Greek and Latin philosophy in Paris, not medicine. And even if natural scientists of the time were aware of sperm as separate entities rather than a homogeneous substance, it occurred to me that they probably didn't have any idea what sperm actually did. Wherever did you think babies came from? I demanded, after a certain amount of enlightenment regarding eggs, sperms, zygotes and the like, which left Jamie distinctly squiggle-eyed. He gave me a rather cold look.
And me a farmer all my life. I ken precisely where they come from, he informed me. I just didn't ken that, all of this daffery was going on. I thought a man plants his seed into a woman's belly and it, well, grows.
He waved vaguely in the direction of my stomach.
You know, like seed. Neeps, corn, melons and the like. I didn't ken they swim about like tadpoles.
I see. I rubbed a finger beneath my nose, trying not to laugh.
Hence the agricultural designation of women as being either fertile or barren.
Mm-hmm. Dismissing this with a wave of his hand, he frowned thoughtfully at the teeming slide.
A week, you said. So it's possible that the wee lad really is the thrush's get.
Early in the day as it was, it took half a second or so for me to make the leap from theory to practical application.
Oh, Jemmy, you mean? Yes, it's quite possible that he's Roger's child.
Roger and Bonnet had lain with Brianna within 2 days of each other.
I told you, and Bree, so.
He nodded, looking abstracted,
then remembered the toast and pushed the rest of it into his mouth. Chewing, he bent for another look through the eyepiece.
Are they different, then? One man's from another, I mean.
Not to look at, no.
I picked up my cup of tea and had a sip, enjoying the delicate flavour.
They are different, of course. They carry the characteristics a man passes to his offspring.
That was about as far as I thought it prudent to go. He was sufficiently staggered by my description of fertilisation. An explanation of genes and chromosomes might be rather excessive at the moment.
But you can't see the differences, even with a microscope.
He grunted at that, swallowed the mouthful of toast, and straightened up.
Why are you looking, then?
Just curiosity. I gestured at the collection of bottles and beakers on the countertop. I wanted to see how fine the resolution of the microscope was, what sorts of things I might be able to see.
Oh, aye? And what then? What's the purpose of it, I mean?
Well, to help me diagnose things.
If I can take a sample of a person's stool, for instance, and see that he has internal parasites, then I'd know better what medicine to give him.
Jamie looked as though he would have preferred not to hear about such things right after breakfast, but nodded.
He drained his beaker and set it down on the counter.
Aye, that's sensible. I'll leave you to get on with it, then.
He bent and kissed me briefly, then headed for the door. Just short of it, though, he turned back.
The, sperms, he said, a little awkwardly.
Yes.
Can you not take them out and give them decent burial or something?
I hid a smile in my teacup.
I'll take good care of them, I promised.
I always do, don't I?
There they were, dark stalks topped with club-like spores, dense against the pale bright ground of the microscope's field of view.
Confirmation.
Got them. I straightened up, slowly rubbing the small of my back as I looked over my preparations.
A series of slides lay in a neat fan beside the microscope, each bearing a dark smear in the middle, a code written on the end of each slide with a bit of wax from a candle stub. Samples of mould, taken from damp cornbread, from spoiled biscuit, and a bit of discarded pastry crust from the Hogmanay venison pie. The crust had yielded the best growth by far. No doubt it was the goose grease. Of the various test substrates I had tried, those were the three resultant batches of mould that had contained the highest proportion of penicillium, or what I could be fairly sure was penicillium. There were a dismaying number of moulds that would grow on damp bread, in addition to several dozen different strains of penicillium. But the samples I had chosen contained the best matches for the textbook pictures of penicillium sporophytes that I had committed to memory years ago, in another life.
I could only hope that my memory wasn't faulty, and that the strains of mould I had here were among those species that produced a large quantity of penicillin.